All day today, we've been turning the clock back. 100 years. In this hour, our assignment is not so much on doctrine, although you're going to hear some doctrine. But this hour is about the brethren. The brethren in an era of 3 years, 1912, 1913, and 1914. So see, our discourse is a lot easier than all the other brethren. They had to cover the whole 100. We just have 3. This is how some of the brethren traveled to local conventions and meetings. Here we have a few of the Cramer Bible student ancestors. Not all of them. They're not all Cramers. This is what some of the brethren sounded like back in the 1912 to 1914 era. How some of the brothers dressed. Now, friends, this is not about theatrics. This is not the place for theatrics. But this suit has a special meaning to this speaker that I did not know until this preparations were undergone for this convention. The suit that we have on was made somewhere between 1907 and 1915. It was made for John W. Cramer, my great-grandfather, who came into the truth in 1894. He was almost exactly contemporary with Brother Russell, if you get a sense of when he lived his life. Brother Russell was about 4 years old when my great-grandfather was born, and my great-grandfather died in 1922. But as we said, in this hour, our focus is not so much on doctrine, but on the brethren in this era. We want to take a look at the brethren's perspective, their inspiration, their activities, and the world around them. Now, in this hour, you may hear some things that you have not read or heard before. Some of the things may even appear exaggerated, but we'd like to assure you up front that we are confident they are not exaggerated. Nearly everything that you'll hear was taken from the reprints that we normally skip over in the 1912 to 1914 era. The annual reports, the itineraries, the speaker assignments, and so on. You'll also hear, by the Lord's grace, if everything works, from a few of the saints that have gone beyond the veil. An acknowledgement up front, we wish to thank the many brethren who assisted in the compilation of this presentation. We are especially thankful for the visual aids that you will see, because without them, be assured, you would not be seeing any of them. So we thank each of the brethren, and there were several who assisted. Deep down in their hearts, what were the brethren of the 1912 to 1914 era appreciating the most? Well, one possibility was knowing that the Lord had finally made his long-awaited and anticipated return. Or maybe it was the earnest expectation of being glorified in 1914, as has already been mentioned from this platform. Or maybe it was the excitement over escalating world tensions and the imminent meltdown of the present evil world. Or perhaps it was the excitement over natural Israel's restoration, which had gotten underway. We suggest that all these points and many others were deeply appreciated by the brethren back then. But there was something more fundamental, something that was actually underlying all these things and others. The brethren in 1912 to 1914, we suggest, appreciated mostly their freedom, their liberty. Friends, the Jubilee trump, the trump of freedom had sounded. By 1912, all six volumes of Studies in the Scriptures and Tabernacle Shadows had been written, published, and widely distributed around the world. The Lord used the Studies in the Scriptures to liberate the brethren from the suffocating Dark Age creeds that had bound so many for so many centuries. Using the sword of his mouth, that is to say the truth, the Lord began to smite every evil system and every evil custom. Let's watch and listen as the Lord essentially declares war on the creeds.
Real Bible study is only beginning. Heretofore, our reading and studies were hindered by our creeds. Now, nobody would think of defending any of the creeds. But as our faith in human creeds dies, our trust in the Bible as the vine increases because we understand it better. In the second century, the mistake was made of proclaiming apostolic bishops of equal authority with those 12 chosen by our Lord. Bibles were costless. You could read. It was natural that the people should accept the teachings of the apostolic bishops without proving their doctrines by the Bible. As a result, there was no Bible study for 1,400 years. No wonder the faith, once delivered to the saints, was lost. Now we are returning to the Bible. The present Pope urges all Catholics to study the Bible and warns all against modernism, higher criticism. After so long neglect of the Bible, it is not strange that the twist and colouring of the creed still gives us trouble. Errors and superstitions die hard. Todd Bird will help us to a broader view of the Bible's lessons. As our heads get straight, may our hearts respond loyally to God and His truth.
One of mainstream Christianity's favorite creeds was hellfire and eternal torment. A fiery netherworld, that concept was first conceived by ancient pagan philosophers. It was embraced by mainstream Christianity, both Catholic and Protestant. And it was popularized worldwide by Dante's Inferno in his epic poem called Divine Comedy, written in the early 1300s. And most of the world accepted and believed in this evil doctrine. In the 1900s, brothers such as Barton and Russell and others gave discourses entitled, Where Are the Dead? In 1909, a booklet was published using the same name, and in 1910, the Watchtower published a booklet bearing the same title. This title used the Bible to expose the origin and the fallacy of this diabolical doctrine. And the slaughter of this and other creeds, friends, was not just some academic victory. It was not just something they appreciated in their heads. It inspired the brethren to activity. Brethren of all ages.
I was in kindergarten there at Loveland when one of our little schoolmates died. And the school teacher had mentioned to us in our kindergarten that little Mary, that was her name, had died, and she went to heaven. So I went home and told Mother. I said, this little girl died, and the school teacher said she went to heaven. Well, mother says, no, she didn't go to heaven. She's asleep, waiting for the resurrection. So mother told me about it, and I said to my mother, well, why does the school teacher say this? Well, because she doesn't know better. Well, what can we do to help her? And she said, why don't we give you some booklets? So she gave me booklets, Where Are the Dead? And I remember going to school with enough booklets to put in the mailbox for every school teacher in that school. I still remember reaching up and putting those little booklets in the respective areas for the school teachers to receive. So that was my first opportunity to witness in that capacity.
By 1912, the truth movement, or the truth outreach, that was very mature. It was a well-oiled machine that had many parts that were all running in high gear. The parent corporation was the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society, incorporated in Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, on December 13, 1884. The Watchtower Bible and Tract Society had two corporate subsidiaries. One was the People's Pulpit Association, which was chartered in the state of New York in 1909. And the second was the International Bible Students Association. It was chartered in Great Britain in 1913. Although these names, People's Pulpit and IBSA, had been used prior to the incorporation of these two entities. But the Lord used these three entities to preside over many dimensions of the harvest work. To name just some of them, Cole Porter, Pilgrim, conventions, tours, numerous publications, the newspaper sermons, class extension, volunteer extension, photo drama, and others. The Truth Outreach started out as a work done in the continental U.S., but soon expanded well beyond the borders of the United States. By 1914, the Watchtower, through the People's Pulpit Association and the IBSA, had a solid footprint on every continent. The Watchtower had branch offices in the UK, Australia, Germany, Sweden, Norway, Scotland, Jamaica, South India, South Africa, and Denmark. All of this and more constituted a global truth delivery system. And this system operated more efficiently than any other system on earth. Why? Because the Lord staffed this entire system with volunteers. Volunteers who had a passion for what they believed and had a passion for wanting to share it worldwide. Time and space today permit us only to look at a small slice of these activities, this one-of-a-kind system. In April of 1881, the Lord, through the Watchtower, proposed the idea of truth colporters, ordinary brethren going door to door looking for hungry sheep, one-on-one witnessing of the truth to those having hearing ears. A colporter is generally defined as a peddler of religious books. But the truth colporter was more than just a peddler of religious books. The truth colporter did two things. First of all, the colporters gave an absolutely 100% free tract to every person that they called on. And second, for those who were more interested, the colporters offered for sale publications that were offered through the Watchtower, such as Bibles, Watchtower subscriptions, studies in the scriptures, and other truth materials. Colporters were to be self-supporting purveyors of the truth. No stipend, no salary. They kept only enough of the sale proceeds to defray their out-of-pocket living expenses. The rest, if there was left over, went back to the Watchtower office to be used elsewise. Although this work may be seemingly insignificant to some, the coal ordering quickly became, and it remained the engine. It was the driving force. It was the locomotive that pulled along the global truth delivery train. The Watchtower gave coal ordering the absolute highest priority of any work that was done. No other work was to interfere with it, not even mass successful witnessing work such as the photodrama. The reason is that coal ordering was so efficient, and it was incredibly productive. The coal porters were dubbed the most efficient workers of the harvest work, the most efficient servants. In 1914, 47 million tracts were given out in the United States. Many, not all, but many of these were given out by the coal porters. 47 million tracts for the year computes to 128,000 tracts given out every day, 365 days, 1913. If only two people read each tract, those 47 million tracts preached almost 100 million sermons in 1 year. In 1914 alone, the coal porters in the United States sold 700,000 volumes of studies in the scriptures. That computes to 2,000 volumes sold every day, 7 days a week, and that was only in the United States. And 1914 was not unique. Other years in that era witnessed a similar level of activity. Our point is this. Coal portering was the number one way that studies in the scriptures was distributed around the globe. You didn't find them in bookstores. It was the Lord's own delivery system that delivered those volumes. Coal portering was the number one way that the truth seeds were scattered around the world. By the 1890s, Brother Russell was getting many invitations to go, travel, and serve many local ecclesias everywhere. But his limited time and the enormous responsibilities he had at the Watchtower office did not permit him to visit these classes. Yet the Lord indicated that there was an important personal pastoral work that needed to be done. So on September the 1st, 1894, the Watchtower announced a new branch of work, the Pilgrim work. Pilgrims were the ambassadors, we might say, of the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society.
In 1914, I received a telegram. I resigned from my job, and Brother Russell told me in a month I would hear from him. I got the letter. And it is a route sheet with just a few lines from Brother Russell saying, I am enclosing a route sheet from Portland to such and such an appointment. We trust as you enter the pilgrim service, it will prove a blessing to you and the brethren whom you serve.
The pilgrims represented Brother Russell personally in where they went. If Brother Russell wanted to counsel or to pastor these local ecclesias, he did so largely through the Pilgrim Brothers who traveled. But yet there's an irony here. While the Pilgrim Brothers represented Brother Russell personally, yet they were not to preach Brother Russell.
You know, Brother Russell used to write what he called pastoral letters. And sometimes he would send these pastoral letters to the pilgrim. I remember one. It was a short one. And I've never forgotten it. And it read, we regret that it again becomes necessary to call the attention of the pilgrim staff to the fact that there is too much preaching of Brother Russell and too little of Jesus Christ. I would recommend, brethren, that you preach Brother Russell less, better still, not at all, and Jesus. Christ more. Brother Russell told me of his experience on one occasion with the pilgrim staff that he never put anyone into the pilgrim service, and he never put them out. That was the Lord's arrangement.
Because of the profound influence that the Pilgrim Brothers would have on the brethren, the Watchtower carefully screened each pilgrim. Even though they were selected by the Lord, the Watchtower felt responsible to screen them. They had to possess 8 qualifications. Interesting how it starts. Impeccable moral character. Not understanding the truth, impeccable moral character. Meek. Third, clear in the truth, especially clear on the doctrine of the ransom. Ability to teach, humble, and not a novice. Now, the pilgrims were to be largely self-supporting. They, too, were strictly volunteers. The Watchtower did assist with travel expenses, but the pilgrims received no stipend or salary. The pilgrims were generally not well known, and in some cases, some of the pilgrim brothers were not known at all in the areas where they were going to serve. So the Watchtower sent them with either a certificate or a letter of introduction that was signed by the Watchtower president. This letter also served as a commendation or as an endorsement, if you will. This evidenced that these brethren were not false brethren. These brethren were not deceivers. They were not wolves in sheep's clothing. They were genuine. And that they were competent to lead meetings. They were competent to conduct immersion services and to serve the emblems and so on. Pilgrim work was completely different from the colportering work. The colporters were to find the hungry sheep. And the colporters followed up, and they were to build and strengthen the sheep once found. The idea of the pilgrims was not to go somewhere and become permanent preachers where they served. The pilgrim brothers generally stayed only 1 or 2 days in each area where they went to serve. Pilgrim services were not conventions. So these were not conventions. Conventions were yet a different kind of service. The pilgrims did such things as they taught the brethren how to organize a class, how to conduct a volume study, how to testify, or how to conduct a testimony meeting. Or they answered questions that the local ecclesias would have. The pilgrims encouraged the local brethren to stay active in the work, to do such things as read the manna every day, to have Berean studies, and as much as possible, read 12 pages per day in studies in the scriptures. The pilgrim brothers were to try to help the weary sheep, the lame sheep, and the sick sheep. They did give limited public talks, but they were very limited because the primary purpose was not to find new interest. That was the job of the colporters. But yet the Pilgrim Brothers did give limited public talks in large cities as a supplement, as an encouragement to the local witness work being done. By 1912 to 1914, the Pilgrim branch of the surface of the work was very mature. And it, too, was highly productive. For example, in 1913, there were 80 Pilgrim Brothers traveling throughout the continental United States. They traveled 883,000 miles in 1913. Nearly 1 million miles were traveled by 80 Pilgrim Brothers. They conducted 17,000 meetings, at which 1.3 million brethren and others were served. A similar work was done in 1912 and in 1914. And of course, as we mentioned, these numbers include only the work in the continental U.S. Many pilgrims traveling many thousands of miles, worked abroad. Friends, when we stop to think about it, many of us have these faithful pilgrim brothers who virtually lived out of a suitcase and ate strange food every couple days, slept in strange beds every couple of days, and other aspects. We have these brethren, many of us have these brethren to thank for the existence of our ecclesias. In 2014, the current year, to have a secular newspaper report on a convention would be unusual. To have the local Columbus newspaper show up here with a reporter and report on this convention would be rather odd, wouldn't it? I've never seen that happen in my short life. To have a secular newspaper publish a Bible discourse is unheard of to this speaker in 2014. And to have the general public demand that the newspapers publish Bible sermons is absolutely unthinkable in 2014. But friends, it was not so 100 years ago. Newspapers were the way that people stayed connected with the entire world around them. Commercial radio broadcasting was only in its infancy in the 1900s, the early 1900s. Commercial radio broadcasting really did not mature until the 1920s and in the 1930s. As an example, KDKA Radio, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, was the first U.S. licensed commercial broadcaster, receiving its license in October of 1920. Still on the air today. Commercial television broadcasting was almost non-existent until after World War II. So by 1912 or 1914, radio and TV, if we can imagine this, radio and TV were not the way that people got their information. By contrast to the radio and television business, the newspaper business was mature. The newspaper business was global, and the newspaper industry was powerful. The Lord well knew the power of the press, and He caused the brethren of this era to take full advantage of the power of the press. By 1904, only three significant or large newspapers were publishing Brother Russell's sermons. In the next 10 years, three newspapers became thousands of newspapers. In 1912, a little over 1,000 newspapers in the United States and in Great Britain published Brother Russell's sermons weekly. Brother Russell would deliver a sermon. For example, the sermon that he gave concerning Armageddon that he delivered at the Brooklyn Academy of Music on November the 3rd, 1912. Newspaper reporters would be there, and they would report on this discourse, and they would in turn provide it to their newspaper syndicates to distribute to each of the individual papers. At this time, there were 1,500 newspaper editors in many countries that were supporting the newspaper sermon work. By 1913, 2,000 newspapers spread across every continent published the sermons. These sermons were translated into over 30 different languages. They reached 15 million readers every week. The press dubbed Brother Russell as the world's ubiquitous preacher. Ubiquitous, I had to look that up. It means everywhere. And 4,000 newspapers worldwide reported on truth activity, which went beyond just publishing the sermons. Best of all, the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society paid nothing to the newspapers to report on the activities and to publish the sermons. The sermons and the truth reports were not advertising. They were news. And they were delivered as such. No religious outreach had ever been accorded such attention. The popularity of the sermons with the press was unprecedented. But why? Why did the newspaper sermons resonate so deeply and broadly with the newspapers and with their millions of readers? Well, newspapers back then had religious departments. Newspapers deemed it their responsibility to publish all kinds of matters, including religious matters. Now, in the early 1900s, many people began to reject denominationalism. There was a great falling away from the churches. Most of the ministers were preaching evolution. They were preaching higher criticism. They were preaching unbelief in the Bible. In response, the people became independent thinkers. They were thinking independent of the denominations. They could see that the minister's message was at odds with the Bible, and many no longer wanted to hear this kind of a message, this anti-Bible rhetoric. Instead, the people wanted the Bible. The denominational pulpit had lost its power with the people. The independents became the big congregation. The Lord raised up Brother Russell as an independent. He rejected the creeds. He rejected the anti-Bible rhetoric. His message was different. It asserted a solid belief in the Bible. And this message appealed to the common man. It appealed to the Christian. It appealed to the Jew. It even appealed to the honest-hearted skeptic. It was affectionately styled, he was affectionately styled, the people's favorite preacher. The truth message was the perfect fit for the press. Every week, newspapers published the truth to their millions of readers. For many, the newspaper sermons were the only sermons that many of these people heard because they had left the churches. Now, as expected, the churches opposed the newspaper ministry. But the Watchtower was undaunted. They steadfastly encouraged the brethren to write to the editors of your local newspapers, brethren everywhere. Encourage the editors to continue publishing the sermons despite the opposition and faithfully subscribe to the papers publishing the sermons to support them. Zion's Watchtower was essentially a newspaper, or perhaps today we would call it a news magazine, a religious news magazine. But the Watchtower, the Zion's Watchtower, never had more than about 45,000 subscribers at any one time throughout its history. Well, and it never was translated into more than about 6 languages around the world. But it is wonderful and heart of faith strengthening to each of us to see that the Lord devised a way to leverage the work that was being done by the Zion's Watchtower magazine. He arranged a completely separate distribution system to preach the truth to untold millions. Interestingly enough, the Lord used secular newspapers to preach the truth in over 30 languages to a global audience. Week after week, year after year, free of charge. To the Watchtower. In September of 1911, the IBSA sponsored a 10-day convention in Mountain Lake Park, Maryland. An average of 6,000 brethren, yes, 6,000 brethren attended the convention each day of that convention. At this convention, the IBSA appointed a committee. It was a committee of 7 brothers to tour the world. Now, the 7 are sitting in the front row. It does not include the brothers standing in the rear. The IBSA wanted the committee to conduct a global evaluation. What is the true condition of affairs, primarily in the Far East, in the Oriental lands? Are there any saints there? Should the IBSA budget money to spread the gospel there? In 1912, some 1,500 newspapers around the world were preaching the truth, as we mentioned. The editors of these papers sought out the IBSA's perspective on the Orient. These newspaper editors wanted to describe the Orient to their millions of readers through the eyes of the IBSA. And the IBSA cooperated with the newspapers, again, knowing the power, incredible power of the press. The newspapers, of course, wanted to draw more attention to the sermons that they published. So they arranged for this 1912 world tour. The newspapers arranged for this tour. And they arranged for many other prominent tours that we have no time to cover today, such as the 1912 European tour, the 1913 transcontinental tour, and the 1913 Southern Convention tour, and others. The tours created news. And news drew attention to the sermons. And so by the IBSA cooperating with the press, the truth was further served worldwide. The four-month Westward tour began on December 5, 1911, and concluded on March 31, 1912. Stops were made in Hawaii, Japan, China, Malaysia, India, Egypt, Greece, Italy, France, England, and of course then back to New York. So this tour went westward all the way around the circumference of the globe. Part of the tour included the IBSA brethren, the committee, visiting the Great Pyramid. The uniqueness of the Great Pyramid was of interest to the world. It was of interest to the newspapers. And again, the press wanted the IBSA's thoughts on the Great Pyramid to in turn share with the millions of newspaper readers. After arriving home, the committee reported that the people of the Orient are not heathen savages. You see, that was a misconception at that time. Few Christians dwell there, reported the committee, because there's so much religious darkness in many of the lands that they visited. Yet the truth message that was delivered during the tour was well received and should be continued. So the IBSA arranged for free literature to be published in the principal languages and distributed in India, China, and Japan. So with this trip, more global attention was brought to the truth, and the IBSA served the world by helping to correct misconceptions about Orientals. Silent movies had become quite popular in the early 1900s. Legendary silent comedian Charlie Chaplin made dozens of silent movies. You know what the average length of a silent movie was at that time? About 12 minutes. Pretty short piece of entertainment. But the people these things were becoming quite popular. And so the Lord quickly capitalized on the people's newly found interest in the movies. In 1910, the Lord conceived the idea of using motion pictures, in part, to teach the Bible. In 1913, the IBSA adopted a formal resolution supporting this idea of, in part, teaching the Bible using movies. The project progressed, and on January 11, 1914, the photodrama debuted in a first-class theater in New York City. The entire program was 8 hours long. It was shown in four separate parts. One part, and only one part, was shown per day in the large cities. Now, the format of the photodrama was twofold. A portion of the show was presented in terms of slides, or in the format of slides, using a slide projector, essentially. The other portion of the photodrama was presented as motion pictures. In each format, the slide format and the motion picture format were used intermittently. So there'd be some slides and then some motion pictures. Slides, motion pictures. And that was the whole program. That's how it was laid out for the entire 8-hour program. Part one of this photodrama explained God's mighty power in creating the earth and in creating man. Part two dealt with the reign of sin and death. Part three focused on God's promise to eradicate sin and death through the Christ. And part four looked mostly to the completion of the church and the millennial age blessings to follow.
All of us who witnessed the preceding parts of this drama are hungry for part four. Now we are to trace the experiences of the church from Pentecost to the present time. We are anxious to look beyond the veil into the future to obtain a glimpse of the church in the heavenly glory as Christ's bride. More than this, we would anticipate the blessings of Messiah's reign in the human uplift from sorrow, sin, crying, and dying to perfection and joy in the Creator's image. But before stepping forward, let us cast the eye of understanding backwards and mark carefully the lessons of the three parts already presented. First, the mighty power of the Creator and His wisdom as manifested in the material universe. Man, the crowning feature made in his Creator's moral likeness. Second, remembering the deflection of Lucifer to Satan, the beguilement of Eve, the disobedience of Adam, and the consequent reign of sin and death should impress the lesson of obedience to God. Third, God's promise by and by to restrain sin and death, and through the glorified Savior as the King of glory to deliver all the willing and obedient from their weaknesses, should inspire us with hope and with love for God. Fourth, let us remember the words of Jesus. It was necessary that the Son of Man should suffer and enter into His glory. Let us remember that all who walk in His steps must suffer with Him, if they would also reign with Him. Let us remember that Christ's body or church will be completed by the glorious change of the first resurrection, before the establishment of Messiah's kingdom to bless the world.
In a sense, the photodrama of creation was technologically unique. More accurately, a part of the photodrama was technologically unique, breakthrough. In a word, the photodrama was the first major synchronized talking movie for those portions that used moving film. Let's watch Brother Russo as he introduces the photodrama. Watch closely the lips and listen to the words.
The photodrama of creation is presented by the IBSA, the International Bible Students Association. Its aim is public instruction along religio-scientific lines and in defense of the Bible as the inspired Word of God. Many claim that each of its parts is more helpful than a year in college, or the four parts equal to 4 years or more. We trust that this may prove to be so for everyone now present. As the motive of the enterprise, we reply that it is purely philanthropic. It is supported wholly by voluntary contributions, and these come from Bible students who themselves greatly benefited, are desirous of passing the blessing on to other hearts and heads. Surely the value of an intelligent knowledge of God and the Bible is inestimable. The photodrama of creation presents the 7 days of creation as 7 epochs, each 7,000 years long, and the 7th day as not yet complete. In this view, 1,000 years of the 7th day remain, during which Earth and her population will reach the grand perfection designed by the Creator. It is held that this final 1,000 years has already begun. To this fact is accredited the great progress of our day, intellectually and materially. In other words, the great 7th day of the Genesis account is itself a great week, each day of which is 1,000 years long. The 6th already passed has been man's work week, a struggle against sin and death, under the curse pronounced in Eden. Now the great Sabbath is beginning. If God has promised that the curse shall roll away from before the blessings of Messiah's kingdom, for which so long we have prayed, thy kingdom come, and of which we have so often sung as the sweet by and by.
What you just saw was not Brother Russell doing a live introduction. What you saw was Brother Russell on screen. His image had been pre-filmed or pre-recorded, and his voice had been pre-recorded. Skilled brethren operated the moving film machine, as it was then called, while other brethren synchronized the phonograph that reproduced Brother Russell's words. Two different machines working, not connected to each other, to do what you just saw. With precision timing, trained brethren coordinated the presentation of an estimated 2 miles of intermittently presented film, 26 phonograph records, and approximately 500 glass slides covering over 150 topics. He says it's like 4 years of college. But such coordination in the film industry was unthinkable in 1914 because all of the coordination, all of the synchronization had to be done manually. 1912 to 1914 was an era rampant with skepticism and evolution and higher criticism, as we mentioned. The world was rushing madly into disbelief in the Bible, plunging headlong. Even consecrated Christians, some of them, were falling victim to this disbelief in the Bible. The photodrama was designed in part to be a counterattack. It was not designed to convert the world, but rather the Lord used the photodrama to help especially the consecrated, to protect them or to bring them back from infidelity or atheism, to reassure them that 3 things, the Bible and history and science, are all in harmony. That's the 3 fingers you see up on the poster. The 8-hour photodrama was heralded as being equal to 4 years of college because it went far beyond just a religious sermon. It taught creation. It taught the universe and history. There were 96 separate lectures recorded as part of the photodrama. After the photodrama debuted in January 1914 in New York City, it spread like wildfire. Within 2 months of its debut, 12,000 people per day were seeing the photodrama in the large cities. The brethren made not one full photodrama system, but 20 of them. 20 teams of brethren would move around from city to city, rotating the photodrama equipment. Remember, it's only one part per day. At its height, the photodrama was shown in 60 to 80 large cities every day, and anywhere between 100 and 3,000 people showed up at every showing. But the demand for the photodrama kept increasing, so a truncated or an abbreviated version called the Eureka drama was designed for rural areas, and where there was no electricity in these rural areas, and oftentimes at that time there were not. Interestingly enough, acetylene gas from an automobile gas tank was used to fuel a burner that illuminated the slides. The brethren were very creative. But the demand increased yet further Even the Eureka drama didn't satisfy the demand. And a further truncated version of the photodrama was created called the family drama. And it was developed for home use. You can invite your neighbor over and listen to the photodrama. Meanwhile, the demand to show the photodrama overseas steadily increased. The photodrama was eventually translated into Spanish, Italian, Greek, Polish, Armenian, French, German, Finnish, and Swedish. At every showing, seats were free. No collection was taken, and free literature was passed out. One of the free handouts was called The Scenario, and it essentially was a printed summary of the photodrama. And by way of talking film, the IBSA offered this free handout in two different forms.
We exhort you to study the free scenario, the printed copy of this lecture. Turn up its Bible references at home with your family. The story will double your interest in the things of God, your desire to serve Him, and to do good to all men. It is obtainable in substantial binding at a small price to cover costs. In the folder form, it is free. Send copies to your country friends who cannot see the drama.
By 1916, millions of people around the globe had experienced the photodrama. The photodrama was one of the Lord's crown jewels of the harvest work of that era. There were many original aspects, many unique aspects to the 1912 to 1914 harvest work. Not since 2,000 years earlier, not since the days of the apostles, had some of these things been done or taught or presented. But one of the most unique features of all the things we could mention, one of the most unique features that appealed to our minds is that this work of this era was not about just one man. The truth outreach of that era had a place for everyone who wanted to serve. Service was not limited to ones with special skills, whether someone had oratory skills or not, educated or uneducated, rich or poor, male or female, full-time or part-time, young or old, single-talented or multi-talented, it didn't matter. The Lord reserved a place for every single heart that wanted to serve. We leave you now, friends, with some wonderful admonitions from one of the Lord's saints of the 1912-1914 era.
Looking back over a century, my advice to anybody younger is to fill their minds with the good things of the truth, because they're going to need them when eyesight goes and health goes. Dear brethren, I urge you to use your time, talents, privileges, and opportunities so you can look back with joy and not with regret. God be with you till we meet again.